Glad to see some familiar faces. Good morning. I would like to talk a little bit today about global suffering and personal suffering. I know many people have been very much affected. In fact, some people can't think of anything else but what's going on in the world today. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about how I think practice relates to that. First of all, I'd like to say, having gone as a young woman through the Vietnam War times, that I think perhaps the world situation today is the worst it's ever been in my lifetime. When I was a young woman, I thought that it was possible that this planet was another planet's hell realm. I had a very protected and sheltered childhood, despite, you know, the fact that any family is dysfunctional. I still believed, as a young child, and then on up into my 20s, before experience proved me wrong, but I did believe that given the choice, people would always make the right decision about their actions, the kind decision. I believed that people were only did evil things if they didn't have a choice. But when I became politically active in my early 20s, I had many experiences which challenged that belief and actually were quite devastating to me. I don't think I've ever recovered emotionally from that time. I saw my friends beaten by policemen who seemed every bit as terrified as we were. And of course, in my time, students at Kent State were shot by National Guardsmen who were in the same generation. Lots of fear. Police didn't yet have the kind of experience that they have now with demonstrations. They were out there, just like we were out there. Nobody knew quite what was going to happen. And then there were some very difficult experiences. I had some friends who started a food co-op, which again then was a radical thing. And their dog had just had puppies. And when a policeman came to their house to search it for I don't know what, my friends knew their rights and they refused to let them in because they didn't have a search warrant. So they came in and they took the puppies and smashed them against the wall until all of them were dead. And then I had friends who had to go underground because of retaliation for things like that. Shooting up the Cambridge, I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, shooting up the Cambridge police station. And then going underground, just changing identity and going from place to place. So I actually, as I say, I never really healed from these experiences. And now when I hear music from that time, I can cry very easily. But I've been talking about this lately because déjà vu. And I feel that I still think, even given what I've just told you, that it's worse now, because then it seemed like our political figures, our presidents were innocents. Johnson and Nixon were innocents compared to political leaders now. At least they bothered to lie to us. They didn't just, I mean, they cared about public opinion. They thought that it was something that would affect their lives, their political careers. Now there's no illusion like that. I personally believe that we're engaged in a global religious war between fundamentalism and materialism. So then I ask, what is our individual responsibility in such dark times, in this intense life and death struggle in the world? And, of course, you can feel it all around. Our bodies are very permeable, and we can feel the fear on our streets as we walk down the street. Everyone feels very dark and fearful. Well, you and I, as practicing Buddhists, have actually spent a lot of time, perhaps half our lifetime or more, developing values that are very different from either fundamentalism or materialism. And these values determine the way we live, the way we interpret world events, the way we treat each other, the way we value the future of our planet, the way the work we've chosen to do for our livelihood. These are very different values from either of those. And I think that maybe we should talk about the specific values that we have cultivated. First of all, our central insight as Buddhists is the understanding or the realization of the interdependence of all being. And we understand that there exists, we can feel that there's an invisible Indra's web that connects all being, all form. And so the choices we make for our actions and words reflect this understanding, that we understand that whatever we do, however we speak, however we conduct ourselves, reverberates infinitely through the universe, through all the different filaments of this web, this invisible web. And so the acknowledgement of our interconnection is our guiding value in how we conduct ourselves. And I think one reason that we're so offended by our government is that they don't seem to, when they invade other countries and such, they don't seem to acknowledge or have the same understanding of Indra's web, that if you do something over here, the whole web shakes with any action that's done. And we deplore this lack of understanding, but actually, we act from the same impulse when we dehumanize our leaders. And we view them as a corruption of humanity, different than we who represent real humanity. And when we see them as not part of humanity, we literally dehumanize them in the same way that we think they dehumanize other people. When we ignore our own contributions to the divisions of the world, we too violate this understanding of Indra's net, Indra's holy net. So not only because of the rapacious greed in this world, the casual cruelty of government policies, the ignorance of our fundamental interdependence, because all these actually have always been the hallmarks of human affairs. This current situation is no different from that. But because of that and the unsettling fear and hatred in our own hearts, I believe deeply that our practice is more important now than it has ever been before in my lifetime. And I feel that we must be steadfast and clear in our collective purpose to embody and exemplify an unambiguous and uplifting alternative to fundamentalism and materialism. And I think in this endeavor to embody some other alternative to these two choices, I think that we have an ancient tool. We have our sitting practice. With the unshakable stability that we cultivate with our own individual sitting practice, I think that we can do several things. I think we can understand the contribution that this practice makes to the world. First of all, I think that through sitting, through the stability of it, is we can hold all the separations all the world's separations and divisions in our own heart, excluding nothing, that no point of view is impossible for us. And secondly, I think through sitting practice that we find the courage to face our own warlike aspects and acknowledge the depth of the chasm we ourselves create between self and other, between our own humanity and others' humanity. And to look into this rift is to acknowledge perhaps the unspeakable darkness in each of our own hearts. Looking into this dark heart, we realize we too have the potential to be demonic, to hate, given certain conditions and insecurities and fears. We too are capable of this. We might start small, actually. Have maybe an angry retort to a counter-demonstrator at a peace march. And then find ourselves unintentionally killing something about the spirit of our spouse or our child. And then realizing that this part of ourselves has gone too far. And then we realize it when we actually hurt those we love. And we realize this is something to have paid conscious attention to or intentionally practiced with all along when it finally gets beyond what we ourselves consider an acceptable manifestation of this. So we all, of course, being human, we all have the potential to be killers. And psychological research shows that what most predisposes us in this direction is to deny our own potential for evil, to project it on to other people, and then distance ourselves from it. So taking responsibility for our own dark side is a work of such magnitude that it's rarely done. We can't bear to do this. It takes the stability cultivated through sitting practice to look at ourselves and not flinch away. Or at least if we flinch away, to come back and look again. Flinch away, come back and look again. And when we don't do that, when we can't look at ourselves, then the pain and suffering of war, whether it's personal or global, just continues on through the generations. Just knowing about your dark side is almost as good as not having a dark side. Just knowing about it, you can account for it in your relationships with other people. You can say, well, in this situation, I tend to get very upset and paranoid and defensive. So knowing this, I'm going to be very attentive to any cues which mean that I'm starting on this process. So you can account for it. Suzuki Roshi, at the San Francisco Zen Center, the founder of the Zen Center there, he used to talk about how he was angry at students. But he felt like he could account for that in his behavior toward them in the broad sense, knowing that he was going to meet a student and feeling his anger over something that they had done. He knew that sitting down to see them, there was an agenda. This is accounting for your anger. I also think that our meditation practice enables us to make ourselves into peace warriors or peace mongers, if you will. We can make responses which are informed by the insight of no separation between self and other. Can a bodhisattva think of someone else as an enemy, really? And there's no room for talk of war in the realm of interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, the interconnection. So when you understand interconnection, it makes you more afraid of hating than dying, because you understand the consequences that go on and on, the consequences of your own destructive impulses. And the separation from other beings that locks you into some karma that just keeps going on. And then, if you realize this, you want to use all your power and energy to find a deeper resource to act from. For instance, a very effective program in recent program that's been developed in jails and in workshops for domestic abusers is to have someone who's been abused, often a woman who's been battered in her family, or a gay person who's been the object of a hate crime, to invite people like this to come in to a workshop of people who have been arrested for domestic abuse or whatever, and describe how it feels to be abused and to be victimized this way, to actually give the graphic emotional and physical details of this. Amazingly, this program is tremendously successful in making abusers say, oh my God. I mean, you'd think people would know going into slapping someone how that feels, or hitting someone, or planning some kind of vicious crime. But that's not so. Confronted with the humanity of victims has a tremendous impact on people. So this is what I'm talking about as far as understanding that there's actually a point of view that in which there's no separation between self and other, because that's what these people are experiencing when they hear someone describe the abuse. So being a peace warrior in the Shambhala tradition, in the Vajrayana tradition, is a very demanding, it has a very demanding and specific set of practices. First, we're asked to study our own agitation and see the thoughts that divide and watch them as they arise. And we all have thoughts that divide us from other people, and just watch them as they arise, not trying to get rid of them, but knowing that they're part of our humanity. We don't exclude them because they may be uncomfortable, because we understand that we need to take responsibility for our own person, for our own being. Thus, we cultivate awareness of our own natures this way. And secondly, being a peace warrior means cultivating the virtue of selflessness, selflessness in the technical sense, understanding that the self is an illusion from the absolute point of view. Of course, from the relative point of view, it's a very convenient and effective illusion. I don't mean to disparage it at all. But from some point of view, creating a self from the absolute point of view is an illusion. We are all part of this interdependence web of humanity and being itself. So the insight of no self is cultivated through our individual sitting practice. And finally, being a peace warrior means making a conscious commitment to kindness and the furthering of connection. I think people are afraid that if they let go of their anger and righteousness at times like these, that they'll lose energy, not be able to be socially active. But actually, I think that you get more strength if you can operate from a feeling of concern and kindness and offer yourself that way. Because you can be just as tough, but effectively tough that way, like a martial art. Often people, teachers of martial arts, don't have hatred for the people that they toss around with their skill. They just do their art for its own sake. And I personally think that the most profound anti-war effort we could ever make is to live an authentic life. The goal of meditation practice is to create a person whose happiness does not depend on circumstances. This kind of life is so deeply fulfilling that you're not interested in waging war for any particular reason I mean, you could even live without a car if that's what it came down to. Whatever the circumstances of your life demand, you can live that life in a state of appreciation. That's the kind of person that is created by meditation practice. And this is one reason I love our practice so much, and my practice, the practice of Zen, but all meditation practice, Vipassana, Vajrayana, this all basically is the same on the level that I'm talking about. It emphasizes just this, or my particular practice of Zen emphasizes just this, what's under your nose, whether it's snot or a bouquet of flowers. It's just this right here, moment after moment. Zen is profoundly anti-idealistic, though it may not look that way sometimes from a glance. Study deeply, it's profoundly anti-idealistic. It asks you to question your ideas of what should be and to try to look at what is without your overlay of opinion or ideals. If you study Soto Zen, which is my training, then the fundamental question is, how do you manifest enlightenment in your everyday life? In other words, how do we express ourselves without any idea of who we are? It's otherwise known, and it could also be said, that this is how do we just do something? No drama, just your ordinary humdrum life. So what is just doing something? How do you just do something? Have you ever tried to just do something? Of course you have. Without anything extra? Like the extra stuff is I'm doing this well, or I'm not doing this well enough, or what am I going to do after I do this, or what will doing this get me? That's extra stuff to the act of doing it. It's pretty hard to just do something. And what's the point of just doing something? I mean, who cares? How does it help the world to just do what you're doing without all these ideas about it? Well, the reason you might care about this, about training yourself to just do something, is that you might want to be able to give your whole heart to your activity, to give your whole heart to whatever you're doing. That is very powerful, your full attention, very powerful, your whole heart. If you give that to your beliefs about interconnectedness and peace, that is very powerful. It will reverberate through the universe. But you might have to train yourself to be able to do something, to be able to give your whole heart, to be totally used up by your activity with nothing left over to be neurotic about. You might want to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which in the short version is just now. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha means now. You might want to live your life fully and deeply. You might want to drop body and mind. You might want to be like Thoreau when he wrote, "There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie among the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness while the birds sang around me. I grew in these seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so over and above my usual allowance." So if you have an experience like this, and then get into a debate with someone about the war, how likely do you think it is for you to hate that person and dismiss them as an idiot because they don't have the same opinions you do? If you have experiences like that, how able are you to hate? Or if you do feel hate and frustration arising during the debate, you certainly would feel it as off balance, as having lost the wholesomeness of your experience that Thoreau describes. So I think from joy, from this kind of experience, one gets the strength and energy to stop harm that's caused by others. If you're joyful and unattached, you get an endless source of energy. But if you approach your peace work with an agenda, such as converting people or changing the government's mind about something, you'll be discouraged if it doesn't happen. Peace work will be exhausting for you. Any kind of social action is potentially exhausting because it moves so slowly. If you do it just because it's right and just because it needs to be done for its own sake, you'll never be discouraged. You'll march month after month, year after year, war after war, injustice after injustice. Embracing the Buddha and the devil at the same time, everything, excluding nothing, finding the reality in each moment. In fact, if any of you have read the latest issue of the New Yorker, the woman who started PETA, the animal rights group, talks about a perspective. You know, she was asked by the interviewer, how could you possibly think your work, which now their emphasis on is on trying to stop people from eating meat, not trying to stop people, trying to educate people into not sacrificing animals for food. And so she was, you know, given the stats, you know, and all this sort of thing. How could she ever think that her work made any difference? And her partner in this, Dan Matthews, I think his name was, started talking about how it just in the last 100 years, how much more humane our world had gotten toward animals, how legislation, and when you, to have reinforcement for what you're doing or encouragement, you have to have this very large scale. You can't think this action, this campaign, this conversion. You just have to do it because you think it's right. And that's how you have the energy to continue doing it. You can't do it for results, which I think is true of many of the things we do. How much more wholehearted we can be when we aren't doing things for the results, but because it expresses our nature. So there are many Zen stories about practicing this way. And I want to give you time for questions, so I'm only going to tell you one, maybe. We'll see how carried away I get. Anyway, a tea master and his student were preparing for the arrival, this is in Japan, were preparing for the arrival of a great tea master, the greatest tea master in Japan. They were cleaning their tea house very carefully. And so finally the student said, well, what's so great about this guy? What makes him the greatest tea master in Japan? And his teacher said, well, he boils water and whisks tea. And the student said, but everybody boils water and whisks tea. And the teacher said, but he only boils water when he boils water. He only whisks tea when he whisks tea. And you know from your own experience that this kind of wholeheartedness is deeply moving to observers. You can tell how immersed someone is in putting on their shoes or in answering the phone when you're on the other end. You can tell if somebody's doing their email at the same time. So maybe that's the only story I'll tell. So we all know what an upright life is, but it's very difficult to live one. What would it be like to just do something without a story around it, or a soap opera in which we're the heroic protagonist? If you have a spiritual turn of mind, you're often tempted when you're washing the dishes or answering the phone at work. You're often tempted to think you're not washing dishes or answering the phone. You're saving all sentient beings, perhaps. Well, certainly, if this is encouraging to you in your sitting practice, continue with thinking that. However, it would be good if you could just answer the phone and just wash the dishes and not think you're doing something special, that you're not distinguishing yourself from the ordinary run of unconscious, idiotic humanity. So it would be good if you, with all beings, washed the dishes and were just an ordinary person. So how do you live your everyday life so that each moment, each activity is realization itself? And this is the quintessential samadhi practice. It's exactly like meditation, like sitting practice. It's exactly like that. In sitting practice, we settle into our breath and we concentrate on our breath. And we train ourselves to have our breath be our whole world while we're sitting. So this is just like the training for everyday life. You focus just like you focus on your breath in meditation. In everyday life, you focus your attention on your direct experience. Direct experience. Of course, you have all these ideas, but you focus yourself intentionally on your direct experience. Your body sensations, your sense impressions, your perceptions. If you do this kind of thing long enough, you can actually see a perception arise. You can see the house, and then you hear from some distance, house, arise in your mind. You can actually slow it down long enough to have a direct experience without a concept. So you become aware of everything, aware of your heart beating, or your relaxation in your muscles, whatever stimulus you have. And this panoramic attention, opening to everything, profoundly grounds us in the present moment, where phenomena flow and change and make no sense. Mark Epstein, in his excellent book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, calls this a breath-based reality as opposed to a time and space reality. He says that in the time and space reality, that's where we crave and dread, because there's stuff in a time-space reality, stuff we want and stuff we don't want. That's time and space reality. But when you shift over time to a breath-based reality, then there's much more flow to it. Yes, desire arises, but it also passes away. Hate arises and passes away. It's much more fluid. And sometimes, in a breath-based reality, you have love and hate at the same time, because in this reality, there aren't any contradictions. It's all just flowing in and out. It's only in the conceptual time-space world that you can even conceive of a paradox, stuff that doesn't make sense. As soon as you breathe, everything makes sense. It just flows. Stuff can be there at the same time, and it doesn't interfere with each other. There are many koans that address this flow. You know, the student will ask a time-space question, and the teacher will respond with a breath-based. One of my favorites is, let's see if I can call it up, is what is the Buddha Dharma? And the teacher says, the fragrant blossoms in the spring. And, you know, this completely befuddles the student, of course. So thoughts and concepts form and dissolve. Now, such a consciousness that is based on breath, this is a consciousness that holds all points of view with ease. All points of view with ease. There's no exclusion. And when a mind can be totally aware of its conditioning, which, as you know, when you sink into your breath, you're very aware of all your conditioning, of your ideas. You have some separation from them because they can't be static in breath-based reality. They're just flowing. They just go past, you know, like a TV screen, you know, like MTV. You know, that's how your mind is when breath is your basis. So then the practitioner, the person who practices this way, is not dependent on any idea, not dependent on anything. And we call this nowhere standing. So how do you manage to invite that little breath of fresh air into the airless cubicles of your opinions? Or that's what mine feel like. And I think our only hope is our consistent sitting practice. Buddhism doesn't ask of us that we believe its tenets. It asks instead that we have Buddha's original insight. We're not asked to believe anything. We're asked to have Buddha's original insight of interdependence. So many of us tend to have really hard political stances that are impervious to any other point of view. And this is an arena in which people have a very hard time looking past their own opinions and seeing their own opinions as just another opinion. So I find it really touching and really inspiring when a person, a single person, can hold self-contradiction, can hold so much paradox, is not troubled by paradox, can hold all the things that you are. And I'll give you an example of a friend of mine who, I've told this story many times, but I love it, so I'll tell it again. This was during the Vietnam War times. She was demonstrating in a peace demonstration in New York City, where she lived then, and the demonstrators had had what was the state-of-the-art demonstration training at that time, which was to link arms and lie down. Therefore, it was very hard for policemen to carry them off and arrest them. But the policemen were doing it. They were dragging each demonstrator one by one to the van and filling the van. It would go to the police station and book them, and then another van would come. So she was being dragged, one policeman on this arm, another policeman on this arm, and they were dragging her toward the van when she heard one policeman say to the other, "You know, this is killing my back." So my friend jumped up to her feet and walked to the van. She said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know you had a bad back." So the policeman spent the next 10 minutes in the van with her, telling her how much he hated to do this work. So I've often felt that her attitude there, the humanity over the idea, over the ideal, is actually what touches another human being, just like the domestic abusers are touched and moved and changed by the details of what it feels like to be abused. So I think maybe the basis for our action, if we don't cling to a particular stance, maybe then the basis of our action is something like love. Not love, not love as opposed to hate, but something like openness, something like love for every atom that exists in phenomena. Something like openness and a willingness to let a little bit of space penetrate our ideas, our prejudices, our strongly held opinions. And we can have our judgments. Judgments aren't bad. We can have our judgments without either expressing them or repressing them. We can make our judgments. But suspending the judgments we have, which we apparently as humans can't not have, this is part of our being human, is having judgments. But suspending them while we embrace life, while we are connected with the stuff of our experience, suspending the judgments that get in the way of direct experience. And this is appreciating the emptiness of our conceptions, that we have the ability to suspend those when love calls. Thank you very much. Do you have a question and answer? Are there any questions? Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the differences that you see between fundamentalism and materialism. Because I think, in my perspective, many people in this country right now are exhibiting characteristics of both. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a bit.
Well, in my view, fundamentalism is actually... is actually a belief in something abstract. I mean, like God or Allah or whatever. It's a belief in something intangible. That's what I'm calling fundamentalism. And materialism, on the other hand, is if you don't see it, it doesn't exist. In fact, there are many Asian Buddhists who think that we don't have Buddhism in this country because we didn't bring all the, you know, all the little devas and stuff like that that is so important in Buddhism in Asia. We didn't bring that over. We have a technological and a materialistic orientation. We were all educated that way. It's very hard for us to think that if we put our hand out, we're separating formless beings. But that is part of Buddhism. That's a fundamental belief. We just haven't, you know, we've taken what is consistent with our education and said we're Buddhists in this way, and many Asian Buddhists don't even recognize our Buddha. I'm not saying it's a good or a bad thing. I'm just making this distinction. We're very materially oriented. And it has a lot of implications for the way we practice Buddhism. Anyway, I consider various forms of fundamentalism to not have that attitude of if I can see it, it exists, and otherwise forget it. There is some belief in some intangible. So for me personally, neither one of them does it for me. I think the world is much richer than either of those stances. Anything else? Yes.
You said something about Suzuki Roshi and how he handled anger and agenda. I just didn't get how it was important.
Oh, just in this particular case, and let's see, I think it's in Ed Brown's new book. It Isn't Always So or Not Always So, I think is the name of it. There's a lecture in there in which he says something to the effect of to know when you know, he was talking about his students whom he actually practiced loving. I mean, he has told some of my teachers that this was a practice of his to learn to love each and every one of his students. He said some it's very hard, but he was practicing learning to love them. So in the midst of that wider practice, sometimes he would be very angry at a person. And knowing that he was about to meet with them, you know, he would account for the fact, he would say, oh, I'm very angry at this person, which I think is a good awareness in a teacher. Because if you're angry at someone, you know, that should be on the table between you right there, so there's no misunderstanding. That you know as a student that your teacher is angry at you and that informs what they're saying. So, but you don't have to be a teacher or a student to practice this assiduously. It really helps with coworkers, with spouses, with friends, with children. If you know that you're angry and you can put it out there. Now, so-and-so, I'm about to criticize you. I'm about to criticize your work or something, but I want you to know that it may be influenced by the fact that I'm angry at you for something that happened the other day. So let's talk about what, you know, what I have to say about something now, but I want you to know I have an agenda from the other day. That really helps both you and the person you're speaking with. And it's just out on the table. It doesn't mean you throw everything out that is shared. It's just accounting for it. Or actually, you can account. It doesn't have to just be an immediate thing. It can also be a lifelong stance. You can, have a belief. And you know that every time you're in a situation. Well, I'm thinking of a student at Zen Center, who was at Zen Center from South Africa for a while, and he was very shocked at, the diversity at Zen Center, which is hardly any. But he was shocked. And so he had to practice with dark peoples, of various kinds. And so he understood that every time he saw a black or a brown face, he instantly thought, what are they doing here with me, in the same place I am? But he had to understand he understood, by the way, Zen Center people didn't make any deal of it. He understood that it was his point of view. And he got better and better at just letting that be after a while. But he had to first be conscious of it and detach himself from it as a true thing. This is outrageous that we're all practicing together, which was his first emotional response. So you can account for the fact, not pretend that it's not there. In fact, it helps very much to know that it is there, so you can account for it whenever you're thinking these things. Oh, that's my conditioning, that's my idea. So it helps. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Could you give a comment or any guidance on that?
Well, I think that since we're all human, we can assume that we're capable of anything that a human being does, including child abuse or whatever. Whenever I find myself repelled by something that I read in the newspaper, I just remind myself that I am capable of that given circumstances. I have been angry enough at my child to slap them. I just haven't done it. I have been angry enough at other people to just, if I had any, legal power, I were a queen or something, I'd just say, off with their head. I understand that. In fact, I always wondered about, the hitmen mentality, of just ordering somebody to go out and kill somebody. This fascinated me as a young woman when I first heard about this, In the mobster culture. And I always thought, oh, that's so terrible, so disgusting. You don't even have the creativity to deal with your own dislikes, And then I finally met a person that I thought, gee, if I knew any hitmen, that would really solve a lot of problems. So I think you do have to look for that in yourself. I think it really helps to have them all in there together. Thanks for your question. Anything else? Yes.
About the other side of that equation, the person who without anger goes out and kills people.
You mean the psychopath? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's the hard one. I can understand being mad, easily understand being mad enough at someone.
Well, have you ever felt just stone cold? Like, actually, I feel that way toward the government a lot. Just so deeply angry and helpless that sometimes I'm just numb, just cold.
I don't remember.
I have felt that way. So one time on acid, I actually understood mass murder. I was just sitting in the back of a van waiting for my friend, tripping, completely, you know, and looking out the window at all these people going by. And then as I watched, I started being frightened of them. And I thought, I mean, it was just a little hole that I slipped into. And I started seeing everyone who passed by the van as personally threatening. And I thought, oh, if only I had some way to defend myself. And then I thought, why, this is what a mass murderer probably thinks. I mean, I'm just guessing, but you know, if I had an M16, you know, in my hand and poor impulse control, there it is. I think it's very helpful to look in yourself for all these possibilities, to look in yourself for the child abuser, the sexual deviant, the murderer, maybe you can't find something. You know, so I'm very happy that your life has been such that these things have not been aroused. I'm sincere about that. Because I'm sure that given, you know, different circumstances, we could develop in a different way, all of us. Anything? Yes.
What do you do when you find the person that brings that out in you? What do you do with that person? It's not anything that they're doing to you, it's just who they are.
Yes, I know many annoying people, actually. I'm sure I'm not alone. It depends on my relationship. I mean, if we can just pass in the night, that's fine. But disturbingly, I find them often among the people closest to me, and then it has to be talked about and worked out. It can't go unaddressed. Just like anger, temporary anger between people. It's another stance. You know, looking at a person from a point of view that is hard and separating yourself from them. Oh, I could never be that mean or that unconscious or that, you know, and then when somebody tells you you have indeed to them been that mean and that unconscious, your first reaction is defensiveness. No, that couldn't be. But of course you grow and let go of certain identities as you allow yourself to be challenged by people. I think this is the importance of a sangha. People just can't develop without a sangha. I see many people who sat by themselves for 10 years. And if you have the discipline to sit by yourself for 10 years, that cuts you off from a certain thing. You don't have poor impulse control. But it might make you a little harder in your stances toward other people because you have been able to cultivate yourself this way. And it, of course, brings some pride. And anyway, not to get too far afield, but practicing with other people and being open to feedback from them is really one of the best development tools. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Sangha is right up there for a good reason. Thank you very much.